Hey, Contra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Contra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are opening, well, a truly monumental book. It didn't just shake up biology, it fundamentally shifted how humanity sees itself. We're talking about Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species from 1859.
Absolutely, it's foundational stuff. And our goal here is to really unpack Darwin's one long argument, as he called it. We want to understand how he tackled that huge question. Why is there such an incredible diversity of life on Earth?
Yeah, how did we get millions of species, each seeming so perfectly, you know, fitted to where it lives?
And his answer, built on just mountains of evidence, wasn't about separate fixed creations. It was about this slow, gradual process he named descent with modification.
Descent with modification, meaning species change over time.
Exactly. They aren't static. They change across generations, inheriting traits from common ancestors way back. And the engine driving this change, natural selection. It's this shift from seeing the world as fixed to seeing it as dynamic, as having a deep history.
Okay, so let's talk about the man himself, Charles Darwin.
Charles Robert Darwin, born 1809. His path wasn't exactly straightforward for a scientific giant. He tried medicine first, didn't like it, then studied theology.
Theology? Interesting.
Yeah, but his real passion, his driving force, was always natural history, just observing the world meticulously.
And that passion landed him, well, probably the most significant scientific journey ever, right?
Yeah.
The voyage of the HMS Beagle.
That's the one, 1831 to 1836. He was the ship's official naturalist. But here's a key point. Was he already thinking about evolution then?
Good question.
Right.
Was he?
Not really, no, not in the way we understand it now. He was primarily an observer, an incredible collector of facts and specimens. That voyage just loaded him up with empirical data, the sheer variety of life in South America, the geology, and critically, those subtle differences between species on nearby islands like the Galapagos.
The famous finches and tortoises.
Exactly. He saw the patterns, but the mechanism wasn't quite there yet. He collected the puzzle pieces, you could say.
What always gets me is that he came back and then waited something like 2 decades before publishing Origin. Why the long wait?
It wasn't procrastination. It was strategy. He spent those 20 years building an absolutely watertight case. That's where his authority comes from.
So what was he doing?
Synthesizing everything. He studied artificial selection. He actually bred fancy pigeons himself, which is fascinating.
Right. I read about that.
Yeah. He corresponded with naturalists all over the globe. And crucially, he brought together these huge ideas from other fields. Charles Lyell's geology gave him the concept of deep time, the immense time scale needed for slow change.
Okay. So the Earth had to be ancient.
Precisely. And Thomas Malthus's work on populations gave him the idea of the struggle for existence. Competition for limited resources. He wove it all together.
He built this mountain of painstakingly gathered evidence, like you said, making sure the theory was undeniable when it finally came out.
Okay, moving into the book itself. Darwin's structure is brilliant. He doesn't start with, you know, weird fossils or exotic islands. He starts really close to home, artificial selection.
Yeah, I found that surprising too. Pigeons, cattle, dogs. Things people in the 19th century knew really well. Why start there?
Pure genius, strategically. He walks you through how pigeon breeders, by selecting tiny desirable traits, maybe a feather type, a particular color, could create dramatically different breeds over generations.
Like the fantail or the pouter pigeon.
Exactly. They look so different, but they all came from the wild rock pigeon. It makes the core idea that selection can cause change really tangible and, frankly, undeniable. He shows that humans do this selective process all the time.
So he eases the reader in, makes selection familiar before taking it into the wild.
Right. Then he pivots. He basically says, look, if humans can do this deliberately, isn't it likely that a similar but undirected process happens in nature, driven simply by the realities of life?
And that reality is the struggle for existence.
That's the engine. He points out two key facts. First, there's variation everywhere. No two individuals are identical. Second, organisms produce way more offspring than can possibly survive.
So limited resources, too many mouths to feed, leads to competition.
Exactly. Constant, relentless competition. And in that struggle, any individual with even a slight variation that gives it an edge, better camouflage, faster running, resistance to a disease, is more likely to survive, reproduce, and pass that helpful trait on. That, in a nutshell, is natural selection.
And the book just relentlessly piles up evidence for this from well, everywhere.
Yeah, from fields that seemed totally disconnected back then. The fossil record, the way species are spread out geographically, anatomy, embryology.
Let's dig into some of that evidence a bit more. Starting with Chapter 1, that variation under domestication you mentioned. Those fancy pigeons really are a powerful analogy.
They really are. If you look at pictures of a pouter with its huge crop or a fantail, it's hard to believe they're the same species as a basic rock pigeon.
But Darwin shows it's just human selection, picking tiny variations over many generations. It really demonstrates how small cumulative changes add up.
And that connects directly to the driver of the whole thing in the wild, Chapter 3, struggle for existence. Now, we often picture, you know, lions chasing gazelles.
Yeah, nature red in tooth and claw.
Right, and that's part of it. But Darwin meant something broader. It's also the struggle of a plant to get sunlight, an animal to survive a drought or avoid a disease. It's just the sheer difficulty of staying alive and reproducing.
It's the Malthusian idea, basically. More individuals born than the environment can support.
Precisely. That pressure, that scarcity, is what makes selection work. Any tiny advantage matters when the margins are that thin. If your variation helps you survive that struggle, your genes get passed on.
Which brings us to the absolute core, Chapter 4, natural selection, or the survival of the fittest. This is where he really puts it all together.
Yes. Variation plus the struggle for existence inevitably equals selection. Nature selects the individuals best suited to their specific conditions. Over vast amounts of time, these favorable variations accumulate. He also briefly introduces sexual selection here.
Ah, right. Explaining things like, say, a peacock's tail.
Exactly. Traits that might not help with day-to-day survival might even hinder it slightly, but significantly improve mating success. That's a distinct kind of selection pressure.
Okay, so that's the mechanism. But the physical evidence he presents is incredibly convincing. Let's look at Chapter 13, specifically morphology and homologous structures. Morphology just means the study of form, right?
That's right. The structure of organisms. And the classic example is the pentadactyl limb, the five-fingered limb structure.
So like my hand.
Your hand? A bat's wing? A whale's flipper? A horse's leg? They're used for completely different things. Grasping, flying, swimming, running.
Okay.
But if you look at the underlying bone structure, it's the same basic pattern. Five digits, wrist bones, forearm bones, upper arm bone. Why? If each was perfectly designed from scratch for its job, you wouldn't expect them to share that common blueprint.
Ah, I see. The only logical explanation is that they inherited that basic structure from a common ancestor, and it was then modified for different purposes.
That's Darwin's argument. It's powerful evidence for descent with modification. And just as powerful, maybe even more so, are the rudimentary organs, what we often call vestigial structures.
Like the human appendix, or those tiny leg bones buried inside some whales.
Exactly. These are structures that seemingly have no function or a reduced function in the current organism. Think about tiny, useless wing stumps under the fused wing covers of some beetles that can't fly.
They don't make sense from a perfect design perspective.
Right. They only make sense as leftovers. Evolutionary baggage inherited from ancestors who did use those structures, ancestors of whales that walked, ancestors of those beetles that flew. These imperfections are actually strong proof of evolutionary history.
One thing I really admire about the book is how Darwin anticipates objections. He doesn't shy away from the tricky parts. Chapter 6, Difficulties of the Theory, tackles the big one. The evolution of complex organs.
Yes, this was a major hurdle. Critics pointed to things like the human eye and said, look how intricate this is. How could it possibly arise by random chance and selection? If you remove any part, it doesn't work. It must have been created all at once.
The irreducible complexity argument, essentially.
Yeah.
How did Darwin counter that?
Brilliantly, I think. He argued it didn't happen in one giant leap. He proposed a gradual sequence. Imagine starting with just a patch of light-sensitive cells, like in some simple organisms.
Okay, better than nothing.
Right, that gives a slight advantage. Then maybe that patch sinks into a pit, which helps detect the direction of light better. Another advantage. Selection favors it.
I see the progression.
Then the opening narrows, like a pinhole camera, improving focus slightly. Each tiny step provides a survival advantage, however small. And over immense time, selection preserves and accumulates these slight improvements, eventually building something as complex as the vertebrate eye. It doesn't need foresight. It just needs each step to be slightly better than the last.
It's about the gradual accumulation of advantageous changes. Makes sense. And then there's the evidence from his own travels, geographical distribution.
Yes. The patterns of where species live. The Galapagos finches are the classic textbook case, and for good reason.
Why are they so important?
Because the finches on different islands were clearly related, but they had distinct beak shapes, specialized for the different food sources available on each island, cracking nuts, eating insects, probing cacti. And crucially, these island finches were most similar to finches found on the nearest mainland South America. The simplest explanation. Ancestral finches migrated from the mainland to the islands, and then, isolated on different islands with different conditions, they evolved differently. Natural selection shaped their beaks for local success.
Migration, isolation, adaptation. It paints a clear picture. So if that's the evidence and the mechanism, what are the big sort of philosophical takeaways, the key themes that really shifted worldviews?
I think the biggest, most profound one is universal common descent. The idea that all life on Earth is related. Everything. Bacteria, fungi, plants, animals, us. We all share a common ancestor if you go back far enough.
The tree of life image.
Exactly. It fundamentally repositioned humanity. We aren't separate, placed above nature. We are part of this immense branching tree. That's a huge shift.
And for that tree to grow so vast and complex, you need that other theme. The immense scale of geological time. Deep time.
Absolutely crucial. Darwin leaned heavily on the work of geologist Charles Lyell. Without billions of years, the slow, gradual process of natural selection simply doesn't have enough time to produce the diversity and complexity we see. Deep time is the canvas evolution paints on.
It really puts human existence into perspective, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Another key theme is the imperfection of nature. This ties back to those rudimentary organs we talked about.
Right, the flaws that are actually evidence of history.
Precisely. Nature isn't like a perfectly engineered machine. It's more like a tinkerer, modifying existing structures based on evolutionary history. Those vestigial bits, the appendix, whale hip bones, they're proof that evolution works with what's already there, not designing optimally from scratch.
History leaves its marks. And finally, this idea that natural selection isn't just about elimination, it's creative.
Yes. It's often seen as purely destructive survival of the fittest means the unfit die out. But by favoring certain traits over others, generation after generation, selection builds adaptations. It crafts the intricate camouflage of an insect, the complex sonar of a bat, the amazing architecture of a bird's nest. It's a blind, unconscious process, but it's incredibly creative over time.
Darwin wasn't just a brilliant scientist. He was a powerful writer, too. Some of his phrasing is just incredibly memorable.
Oh, definitely. Let's share a few key quotes, or at least the essence of them. First, the core logic of natural selection itself. He basically says, as many more individuals of each species are born than can possibly survive, and as, consequently, there is a frequently recurring struggle for existence, it follows that any being, if it vary, however slightly, in any manner profitable to itself, will have a better chance of surviving and thus be naturally selected.
It lays it all out so clearly. Overproduction. Struggle. Advantageous variations survive. Natural selection. Simple, but revolutionary. Then there's the one that connects the harshness to the outcome. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows.
It's stark, isn't it? No sugarcoating. He's saying that complexity, even consciousness, emerges directly from this brutal, competitive process. It's not necessarily pleasant, but it's how life works, according to his theory.
But he ends the book with such a sense of awe. The famous closing lines. There is grandeur in this view of life. From so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved.
It's beautiful. He finds the evolutionary perspective even more awe-inspiring than the idea of special creation. It reveals this ongoing, dynamic, endlessly creative process responsible for all the beauty and wonder of the living world. A really powerful finish.
And this isn't just 19th century history, is it? This thinking is absolutely vital today.
Oh, completely. It underpins all of modern biology and has really practical applications, especially in medicine.
Like antibiotic resistance. We see evolution happening in hospitals right now.
It's a perfect, terrifying example of natural selection in action. We use an antibiotic, it kills most bacteria. But if just a few bacteria happen to have a random mutation that makes them slightly resistant, they survive.
And they're the only ones left to reproduce.
Exactly. So the next generation is dominated by resistant bacteria. We've selected for resistance. Understanding this is critical for developing new drugs and strategies. Same goes for viral evolution, why we need new flu shots every year, or updated COVID vaccines. Viruses evolve rapidly.
It's crucial in conservation too, isn't it? especially with challenges like climate change.
Hugely important. Modern agriculture is essentially supercharged artificial selection, sometimes down to the genetic level. And for conservation, understanding a species' genetic diversity is key.
Why diversity?
Because that diversity represents the raw material for adaptation. If conditions change, temperature rises, a new disease appears. A population needs variations so that at least some individuals might have traits that allow them to cope. Without that diversity, selection has nothing to work with, and the species is much more vulnerable.
So preserving genetic diversity is crucial for future survival.
Absolutely. And more broadly, Darwin's work encourages us to think in deep time, to understand complex systems, and to see change as fundamental. That's a valuable mindset for tackling all sorts of long-term problems.
So wrapping up, what's one thing that really struck you or maybe surprised you revisiting Origin for this deep dive?
You know, beyond the core theory, it's the sheer breadth and depth of his evidence. The way he pulls examples from morphology, embryology, fossils, geography, domestication, it's just overwhelming. It truly underscores that life is dynamic, not static, a constant state of becoming.
For me, it's that inductive reasoning you mentioned earlier, building this colossal theory piece by piece, from observation upon observation, without relying on pre-existing dogma. It's a masterclass in scientific thinking. And the paradigm shift is immense, moving from thinking of life as separate, fixed entities to understanding it as one vast, interconnected, ever-evolving tree of common descent. It changes everything.
A profound shift indeed.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.